Welcome back to Scoreheads, the podcast that celebrates the music of your favourite films, TV shows and video games by going behind the scenes of the composing industry and having in-depth conversations with those that make the notes that emote. I'm John Brown, the resident film correspondent at Express FM and presenter and producer of their film music programme, The Composer Series, as well as co-host and producer of our other film podcast on this very channel, We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod. Joining me as always for each Scoreheads episode is my good friend film music journalist Sean Wilson, who himself is the author of the excellent book The Sound of Cinema, Hollywood Film Music from the Silence to the Present. For this latest show, we're celebrating the wonderful Laura Karpman with a conversation Sean Wilson and I recorded with Laura not so long ago to explore her first foray into scoring for big screen feature films with the Marvels, which of course was huge in cinemas and is soon to be making its streaming digital Blu-ray and DVD debut next month. If you're hearing about Laura for the first time, well, she's a bold, incandescent talent who creates powerful, imaginative scores that push the boundaries of storytelling. Her award-winning music, spanning film, television, theatre, interactive media and live performance, reflects an audaciously creative, prodigious, fresh spirit who has collaborated with the most creative filmmakers of our time. These include Misha Green, Steven Spielberg, Nia DaCosta, Kevin Feige, Alex Gibney, Casey Lemons, Sam Pollard and Eleanor, Francis Ford and Sofia Coppola. Her recent foray into the Marvel Universe has her scoring the eclectic animated series What If, and the newly acclaimed Miss Marvel, which blends bold, driving, heroic orchestral music with authentic South Asian elements to create a unique sound for this groundbreaking superhero. Her celebrated scores for video games and interactive media include Guardians of Middle-earth, Gang award-winning EverQuest 2, Kung Fu Panda 2, Project Spark, Kinect Disneyland Adventures and Untold Legends Dark Kingdom. Across concert halls, Karpman is well known for her Grammy award-winning album Ask Your Mama, a multimedia opera based on the iconic cycle of poems by Langston Hughes. A fierce champion for inclusion in Hollywood, after founding the Alliance for Women Film Composers, Karpman became the first woman governor in the music branch of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and was subsequently elected to be the first female governor of the music branch. Most recently, she masterfully created beautiful scores for both the Marvel Studios' big screen feature film The Marvels and the critically acclaimed and multi-award nominated American Fiction, both with soundtracks that have received widespread acclaim from critics and fans alike, and in the case of American Fiction, earned her first Oscar nomination. She's brilliant, we love her, and just before the end of last year, Sean Wilson and I caught up with her to discuss The Marvels, the debut of What If Season 2 on Disney+, her role with the Alliance for Women Film Composers, and so much more. Her name is Laura Karpman, and she is Sean and I's featured guest on this episode of Scoreheads.
Carol Danvers, prodigal child of the Milky Way.
Nick Fury.
My favorite one-eyed man of intrigue.
How goes it out there?
Cold, no air, space.
Captain Marvel. The Annihilator. You took everything from me. And now I'm returning the favor.
Sean and I are very, very pleased and excited now to welcome back to the show the magnificent Laura Karpman. Laura, hello, how are you?
Oh my God, I'm magnificent. I don't feel magnificent, but I guess now that John Brown said I am magnificent. I'm great. How are you guys?
Doing great, thank you.
Yeah, lovely, thanks.
Excellent. Good. We've very much enjoyed your score for The Marvels, which of course is what we're here to talk about. So I think right off the bat, we'll start right there and just kind of discuss, I guess, from the beginning how, I'm going to guess this came off the back of What If, but if you tell us a little bit of how the genesis of how you got on board with the Marvels and the project.
It did come off the back of What If. Brad Winterbaum, who was the showrunner on What If, now he's the head of all the streaming stuff, I think mentioned to Kevin that he thought that I should be working on the movies. And so it happened, which was just great. Of course, Nia had to, become familiar with my work. And And Sean, before we were rolling, we were talking about Lovecraft Country. I think she was familiar with that work. We sent her some episodes of What If, and I think that gave her the confidence to hire me. And so yes, that is very much a springboard from the work that I had done on What If.
Well, I remember, Laura, talking to you about Lovecraft Country, and you said that in that score, there were so many different genres that were touched upon within one soundtrack. Was that a kind of, was that something that was sought by Nia and the Marvel filmmakers?
No, I don't think, I think it was for What If, you know, because the thing about What If, of course, is that every episode, it's an anthology. So every episode is its own thing. And although Lovecraft Country was not an anthology, I think Misha Green there wanted every episode to really lean into genre. Nia was looking for something that was more, well, I mean, it is certainly not a traditional film score in any way, shape, or form, but she was looking for a main theme for the three heroes, and then looking for all kinds of other stuff in the on the edges. And so we can get into that a little bit. But I think it's mostly she was looking for somebody who could get the kind of the commercial thing done, which you have to for these films, and then be able to be experimental in all these wonderful corners that she created.
Tell us about the theme, though. You mentioned the incredible theme that you've created for the movie, but also, you know, this beautiful music you've made. Tell us about the theme and the genesis of that, but also how the music of the film came together, your inspirations, ideas, and so forth.
Well, I think the first thing was a theme. And it's interesting because we're talking about Lovecraft, which is kind of funny. I think one of the things that Misha Green talked a lot about was having hero music for people that you're not used to seeing as heroes. And I thought a lot about this with Ms. Marvel, too, which kind of came in between these things, even though I was hired on the Marvels before I was hired on Ms. Marvel. But I think the first idea was really to create a fantastic kind of new team theme. You know, so if you look at the history of Marvel, you have, you know, Captain America, but then you have a different theme for the Avengers. They have their own vibe. So I think that was very much the thought. Like, let's create something for the three of them as a team without leaning into the other stuff that had been created for these fantastic heroes in other mediums. So that was the first thing. And I know she loved, you know, she loves that kind of anticipatory building, you know, that Michael Giacchino does so well, or Alan Silvestri does so well. So I think that was a starting point, but also that hummable 2-4 bar theme that is kind of the hallmark of Marvel superhero themes. I had played with something in Ms. Marvel that I really, really loved. And there's a theme for the clandestines, which is one of kind of the bad guys that was this, you know, this constant build and this constant build orchestrationally. So that was something I was really interested in exploring in a different context, in a more of a heroic context for this theme.
In terms of the placement of the theme that we've just been talking about, is it a sense that it has to be earned within the soundscape of the movie? Is it like, does it build? Is it a question of like building up to it towards the climax of the movie? Or was it a sense that we're going to go all in like right at the beginning with it?
No. And in fact, at the very beginning of the theme, you hear the viola, which is kind of in a way where I saw Carol at the beginning of this film, broken, warm and emotive, but fragile. And then you also hear the theme, ba-bi, ba-do-di, you know, kind of broken up with these bell-like textures, you know, that are allophones and celestes and pianos and all these kind of weird, almost like broken shards of glass. So, and they don't play together. Blah, 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 you know, it's just this kind of out of sync thing. And so that's kind of the first minute of the theme, with these kind of slidey strings that, to me, you know, is very much this kind of floating feeling, floating emotionally, floating in space, and all of those things. And then the kick starts, you know, very soft at first. And it goes and it goes and it goes and it goes. And I take it as long as you possibly can take it, without it being repetitive. It's like, I don't know if you've ever heard Bolero, the Ravel Bolero, but that's kind of like a model for this thing, where you've got this constant thing and it's repeated and repeated and repeated, but you keep changing it orchestrationally and adding things so that it's like, oh my God, there's that, and oh my God, there's that, and oh my God, there's that, until finally it explodes into the full-throated expression of the theme.
I love how much heart and power is in that theme, but also reflecting on the film, my next question is, was this entirely intentional? But it did very much give me the feeling of like a blend of a classic sci-fi, but at the same time, like those adventure flicks you used to see on a Saturday matinee, you know?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I thought a lot about space. And I mean, we can get into that because it's there's a lot that I did to sort of sonify space. But is that a word? Sonify? Sonify? I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it sounds right, right? I don't know. Hey, it's Friday after Thanksgiving, you know. I'm compromised, let's put it that way. But, you know, I mean, when you see people floating in space, there's one moment in the film where Carol is going to Tarnax and she's on her spaceship and she's just kind of driving around and the clouds are opening and she's in space and then she lands. And it's so classic. And that was and Aladdin too, when they land on Aladdin. And, you know, these moments where you kind of do lean into what space has sounded like. And I mean, I definitely think of myself, I don't know if I should say this out loud, but I guess I will, as new old fashioned. I really love classic film scores and I love classical music. I mean, that's where, you know, where my whole life has been spent. And so sort of those two things play into my music. But the thing about this particular film that was so cool is there was a lot of room for experimentation, for aleatoric music, for things that really were weird. And it was great because I was able to seed those into the film very early on so they didn't shock anybody.
It is interesting, yeah, when you mentioned space, because when I think of music with space, I often think of like suspensions, and it almost seems like a simplistic term, like twinkly textures or you know, ethereal.
Or French Horn's 2001 Space Odyssey with also Spock's producer, Richard Strauss, and all that, yeah.
Yeah, I suppose, is it a question of, do you try and mix and match the Thus Spake Zarathustra sound with the more sort of ethereal sound, or do you go to one end of the spectrum or the other?
Okay, well, I'm going to break down space in the Marvels for you. You
please
ready?
Do it. Please, please. Yeah.
Because this is 20 minutes of our conversation. All right, so early on we talked about voices. And there has been a history of voices being space, which of course makes absolutely no sense, really, because voice is the ultimate expression of humanity, I suppose. But I'm not the first person who did, you know, who thought of this. And of course, Nia really said, I want a space opera. That was the first thing she said to me. And so we recorded voices early on. And she talked about really wanting to hear low voices. So she wanted to hear, she called them space shanties, like sea shanties, you know? So I put together a group of 8 singers. And I had done this in Ms. Marvel as almost like an experiment for the Marvels, honestly, and it worked so great, which is putting people in a room and saying, don't blend. So for Ms. Marvel, we did all South Asian singers and we kind of created what they were singing in the room. But for this, I got singers from many, many world vocal traditions. And so I had an Indian Carnatic singer, I had a Black African singer, a Black American singer, countertenors, basso profundos, basso profundos. So there was this idea that what happens when you put all these voices together and you have them do these kind of experimental little pieces? And so we had like very loosely structured things like, you know, that type of thing. And so they would do this all not at the same time, all in different traditions. We had, you know, these sounds like these almost like mouth overtone sounds. And of course, the basses, some of them could do real overtone singing. So we played with all that. So I did that early, early on, and I started throwing it in the film. And I did it strategically because as these films kind of go through the process, as, you know, the director listens, as the executives at Marvel listens, as things get, you know, go into test screenings, if you can see some of these things early, then It's not a shock when you finally record them, right? Especially something that you're playing with. Now, of course, you take the risk that everyone's going to hate it and you're never, you know, you're not going to be able to use it. But that was a risk I was willing to take. So Nia loved it and we started seeding it in the movie. So that was great. But I wanted more. And so I contacted an old colleague and friend of mine, Evelyn Glennie, who is she lives in Cambridgeshire. She's a Scottish woman, Dame Evelyn Glennie, I should say. And she's an iconic musician. And one of the things that she does, she's also profoundly deaf. And this actually is very, very relevant because there's no sound in space, only reflective sound. So in other words, you can feel sound more than you can hear it. And that's the way Evelyn experiences all music, right? She often plays barefoot, so she literally feels the vibrations through her body. So we went to her studio in Cambridgeshire and we recorded. Like, we didn't know what we were going to record. We just walked in. It was like these vocal sessions and said, okay, what you got? And she said, well, I've got the largest timpani in the world. And I said, great. What if we take our fingers and just scrape them on the top? You know, so we started creating all these like crazy wild sounds. And actually, I'll give you a nice little spoiler. There's one, this one sound, and it's used in a cue called The Marvels on the soundtrack, but it's the end credit for the film, where literally we're throwing marbles on a steel pan and spinning it around. So The Marvels is in The Marvels. So this idea of recording Evelyn and seeding these unusual sounds into space was also something that I did early on, and they worked fabulously well. And then I decided that I wanted to make sure that I was covered. So we went to actually a prop house here in Los Angeles and rented space junk, like stuff that had fallen off spaceships or had been gotten from rocket ships. And we used those as percussive instruments. And then finally, I started learning about these sonifications that were created, and NASA had commissioned a lot of them, where basically you take data from space and then take that data and map it into MIDI data and then create music with it. And I met this wonderful computer scientist, Christina Tallon, who's also a composer. And I said, hey, do you know how to create sonifications? And she said, well, as a matter of fact, I do. And so I gave her a couple, she signed her NDA. I gave her a couple of plot points in the film. And so she created some sonifications. So that's where... That's what's so fun about this project musically, is that you got that theme, which is, you're right, action adventure. You know, it's got some weirdnesses in it with the viola and the slidey strings and the voices, certainly, but it's straight up Marvel once you get da ba ba da da bo dee bo ee, right? But you've also got all this other stuff sitting in the corner, sitting in all those weird moments when Monica and Carol are kind of floating in space when they're first encountering each other. All of those, especially in Reels 1 and 2, where things are still kind of really uncertain, where they're not working together well and things are not colliding properly. So I use them also in the memory fracs, which are really cool spaces for experimentation. So there you go. There's your long explanation of space in The Marvels.
A welcome
one. That's the answer I could have hoped for. That.
That's phenomenal. Like, so much. I am a huge fan of attention to detail and the amount of heart and soul and effort that's clearly gone into that. That is just fantastic.
Well, you know, it's my first big movie. And it was a gift. It was a treasure. It's something I never expected would happen. And so, like, I just dove in and gave it everything I had. I really did.
Because I said to you, John, didn't I? I said, oh, when we first found out that you were scoring the film, Laura said to John, oh, Laura's got a Marvel movie. I remember being so excited.
Yeah, I remember being really pleased. Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah. It was unlikely, and for a lot of reasons that we can get into if you're interested, but... Yeah. But we just had, I mean, just this whole process was incredible. I mean, Nora and I were just talking about this morning. Nora's my wife, who's a fantastic composer, who scores season 2 of What If with me. But she's also a really good conductor. And, you know, we recorded the score at Abbey Road. And, like, everybody talks about Abbey Road and the Beatles. And, oh, my God, though, that place. is so special. And it's so special, not just because of all the scores have been recorded there, but you talk about attention to detail. I mean, we had Peter Cobbin and Kirsty Whaley, these recordists and mixers. I mean, like, I've never felt so musically understood on every level than I did in those recording sessions at Abbey Road with Nora conducting. And I was musically understood because people understood the complexity in my music. They understood that it's not simple. There was no desire for it to be. Kevin loved the music. Nia loved the music. Everybody, like, it was the first time that a lot of them had played together in a room. We put everybody together. We didn't stripe the score, which, as your listeners know, is you record the brass, you record the woodwinds, you record the strings, and it gives you, you know, optimal flexibility. But we did all of that in the orchestration with Dynamics, just like talked about being new old fashioned. This is what you did, you know, you orchestrated. And so you didn't worry about dialect, because if someone says something, you play softer or you use a lighter orchestration. You know, you don't rely on pulling down the faders in order to accomplish that. But the musicians in London were the finest musicians I have ever encountered. And that experience of recording with Pete and Kirsty and then their mixing of the score and feeling completely understood was just one of the true gifts of my entire life, I have to tell you.
I remember watching the film and looking through the credits and the music credits. I stay for all the credits, but I particularly like the music credits for obvious reasons. Yeah. And I just remember seeing all those names that were working with you and just thinking, you really were in the best hands there. Totally.
Yeah, totally in the best hands. And, you know, we have an all-female studio here. We had almost all female section heads in London. So a lot of people got opportunities to run sections that they hadn't before. And the music, I mean, I think the score sounds as good as any score I've heard. I mean, I'm not talking about my composition. I'm talking about literally the recorded sound of it. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary.
Well, I remember when I spoke to you, Laura, about Lovecraft Country, you mentioned about
very
different, but also the recording setup, the fact that everything had to be done individually and mixed down individually.
Yeah, every single person was recorded individually.
Yeah.
And then we trained them, of course, to be able to do that, because at that point, a lot of people hadn't done that. But, you know, that was cool, too, because the thing about Lovecraft, it was very period, right? It was 1950s. So you had this kind of close-mic'd recording thing that was indicative of that. And that was a surprise. Like, it was not by design. We just kind of didn't luck into it. We were in a worldwide pandemic, but it was a positive result of something that was so painful and negative for all of us. But the converse of that literally was going to Abbey Road in 2023. And a lot of these people had not seen each other or recorded together in all that time since the pandemic, first because of the pandemic restrictions, and secondly, because I think a lot of people got used to the control of striping and recording people differently. And, you know, I had my dear friend Michael Giacchino, who's been, you know, we were governors together at the Academy. He said, put everybody together. You know, he said, just do it. And it was like, okay, let's do it. If Michael does it, let's do it.
It sounds phenomenal. And it must have been really nice as well to have everybody together. And I know we talked about this before, but that magic of hearing that music played live and being in that room. And we talked about this many times, but that must have been truly special at Abbey Road.
It was crazy. And then they did it at the closing night of BBC Proms.
Yes. Yes, they did.
Which was like nuts. Nuts. I mean, I always wanted to go to the proms. It was like, oh my God, I've got to go to London this summer and go to the proms. You know, it's like but as I described it, like, to people who don't know what it is, I said it's the Coachella of classical music, you know? And it is, right? I mean, there are things about it that, of course, are really very truly English. And I use that word very carefully. But it was really, really phenomenal, and people loved it. And the, you know, all the BBC people were just great. And I think the piece they put together, you know, with it, with the roof blowing off of Royal Albert Hall and all of it, it was super cool.
Yeah, I was going to ask, Laura, was that suite put together like with your blessing? Like, what was your involvement with that?
Well, I mean, that is I have made that suite smaller for other things, but that was the music. I mean, I think the only difference is, there was no piano, And Sheku Kanamason did the viola solo because he was there doing the evening. So he played the viola solo high on the cello. But other than that, no, of course. I mean, Marin Alsop is an old friend of mine. We were, I met her when we were in our 20s, both living in New York. We were at Juilliard. And she started an organization called String Fever, which was playing jazz arrangements, like jazz music for strings, which at that point was like nobody had done it. And I did some Fats Waller arrangements for her, which was, you know, really, really funny. And so we've just been friends all these years. And when she said, when I read that she was doing Closing Night of BBC Proms, I said, you should do the Marvels. And she had done it for Pride at Philadelphia Orchestra. So she really loved the piece. And it was a really amazing spot, opening of the second half, and especially for an American. I have to say it was really very touching.
I suppose it must show how superhero movies, but more specifically soundtracks, are now piercing through, right, how they're punching through, because I imagine 20, 30 years ago, that probably would have been, apart from maybe John Williams' Superman and a couple of others, it would have been inconceivable to have a superhero score playing at the prom. So it's a phenomenal achievement. Do you think something has shifted in the ether in terms of industry's perception of scores like yours?
I think so. And I think that there are people who, as you well know, because we're doing a podcast right now for them, who love this stuff. And listening to score soundtracks is, in fact, their interaction with the symphony orchestra. And this happened in video games too, like gamers, you know, where you like, I mean, Video Games Live started touring in what, 2005 or something, early on. Like games started being, and oh God, it's so funny because here they did this, here at KUSC, they're doing this like gaming show on the classical radio station of game music. I mean, 15 years ago, I went to orchestras and said, listen, you guys need to start pairing game music with the classical music that inspires it, because you don't have a game music score without Carmina Burana. Or, you know, I mean, there are seeds in classical music. And it was funny because at the proms they had done, God, it wasn't also Sprach Zarathustra. I can't remember. Oh, Don Juan. It was another Strauss tone poem. And I think it's da 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 da. I may be missinging that. I don't remember. But it was like, oh my God, that's a Marvel snippet. And so you like there are these close connections between classical music and what we're doing in scoring, and of course video game music. And there have always been, but there's been this kind of snobbery which doesn't exist anymore, because you've got really great composers who are doing both, you know, who are doing classical music. I mean, I'm doing it. You have Nick Britell, who scored Secession, is a consultant for a San Francisco Symphony, writing symphonic music. Michael Abels, who just won a Pulitzer Prize, who was discovered because Jordan Peele went looking for a black composer who was a concert music composer. So you have all of these things. And I think the beauty of it is that those of us who are seeped in the classical music tradition, I have a doctorate from the Juilliard School, are now able to be our full and total selves with symphonic complexity, and fans dig it. As long as you give them, as long as Kevin can sing the tune when he leaves a test screening, you're all good.
That's the bar now. Kevin's singing the tune.
Yeah. We were sitting through a test screening and he walked out whistling. I heard him whistling the tune. I thought, I'm good to go.
Aced it. Yeah.
I was just walking back to your point about video game music. I didn't know if you know this, Sean, but the video game music concerts at the Royal Festival Hall, I think it is, yes, in South Bank, they're sold out 2 days in a row. Sold out completely.
And so there, you know, I've been saying this for a long time, like symphonies can bemoan this and that, but they have audiences that are ready to go. And the thing is, you can do that at South Bank. And then throw in Strauss, and everyone's going to get up and wave their lightsabers or whatever they're doing at that moment, you know? And so I think a lot of people are missing education in the schools now because of all the music training and stuff has been dropped out. But they're getting their music in other ways, which is so beautiful.
That's really interesting to think about how music education is mutable and how people learn in different ways. Yeah, maybe outside the formal education system, that people can learn online, they can learn by listening, the scores like yours. That's amazing, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially if you have,
you know, concerts where, I mean, we're all talking about Maestro, you know, Leonard Bernstein's, I mean, as well as being a great composer, great conductor, his probably arguably greatest contribution were the young people's concerts, where he made classical music accessible for young people. And that's what all of this is, including my music in the BBC proms, video game music. All of these things are ways of saying, look, there is contemporary orchestral music being written all the time, recorded all the time. And people want it, and they want to hear it and experience it.
I want to walk back to the movie now and just talk about the singing sequence, which I absolutely adored. I did not see it coming, and it was brilliant. Please do tell us more about how that all came together.
Okay. Well, Aladdin is a singing planet, as you know. And James Murphy wrote two songs for that section. He did two demos. They weren't fully fleshed out, with Brie and Prince Jan singing the duet and then the welcome song when they first come in. So those songs had to be, you know, adapted to picture. They shot playing those songs, right? As you see on camera, they're singing. And then they had to be adapted into kind of the musical language of the film, but also the musical language of Aladdin. And then I did the, you know, going to the crossroads, when they're walking up, when they're walking up into the thing. And I wrote the music in the banquet, which I extended on the soundtrack, which is super fun. And I'll talk about how we recorded that. And then also the, you know, attention, da 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 da, with the guy, the crier who announces the prince coming. And so that was all me. So it was a really nice kind of collaboration musically between the songs that James Murphy had done and then augmenting them, adding voices to them, doing that. We talked about recording some of the small group choirs. I did that as well as a larger choir at Abbey Road. So you have that kind of layered sound and Aladdin as well. And I think conceptually, knowing that Aladdin was coming, it also influenced the rest of the score. But basically, we talked a lot about what kind of music do they have at Aladdin and how, is there an orchestra? Is there a band? And if you know, once the film is available on Disney Plus, you'll be able to pause in Aladdin. And it's hard to see because it goes by so fast. But if you look in the background, there are all these instruments that were built, these incredible props that, like, one looks like a lyre, one looks like kind of a tuba. And so I spent a lot of time looking at those individual instruments, too. And I came to the conclusion, with Nia, of course, that every kind of music is in Aladdin. Like, Prince Jan probably has, like, the banquet introduction. He probably has a small group introduction. You know, that they're probably, like, 20 pieces or 50 pieces that would be recorded for his entrances. Some of them would be big. Some of them would be small. They would be recorded with different kinds of musicians, you know, that the welcome song, you know, you had, like, when they walk in, you had the sound of the orchestra tuning up, people doing little solfege pieces and stuff like that, like warming up. They knew they were coming, so they're preparing the welcome song. And so, and then, of course, every piece of dialogue had to be sung. So if you're thinking about a movie, right? Like, you think about a movie, there's ADR, which is, you know, you get loop groups together and people together to record dialogue. You know, you have a crowd scene. You don't do that all on set. You do that afterwards in post-production. So basically, we did that in London with a choir. And instead of, like, miscellaneous chatter, I had to invent, like, every line that they were saying, you know? So I would have these lines given to me by the dialogue supervisor, and then I would, like, say, okay, you sing, I can't remember what they were, you know, the delightful, but you know, you listen to the soundtrack, and it's just these kind of funny, like, dialogue lines, and, you know, then you have exhalations, you know, when the crowd is reacting to what's going on in the duet, and all of that kind of stuff I created afterwards with the picture. But that was, I love Aladdin.
Is there In terms of the villain's musical identity, Darben, she's played by Zora Ashton, yeah. What was the construction of her identity and how was that offset against the theme for the Marvels?
Well, that had a sort of interesting revolution. That had an interesting evolution. I'm not great at it, but I do it. I love it. And we were at the fencing club. And somebody was playing this Herbie Hancock piece, and it was a Watermelon Man, but it was this crazy kind of flute thing that happened, this pan flute thing. And I thought to myself, God, that would be a great sound for Darben, you know? There's something kind of jazzy about her and slithery. And so I also, at that time, and still do, have a wonderful young woman who's a great, great jazz flute player. Her name is Elena Penderhughes. And she's an intern in our studio. She's learning film scoring. But in between, it's like, oh, I've got to play with Herbie tonight. So she plays with Herbie Hancock. She plays with every major jazz act, Terry Lynn Carrington, you know, Gerald Clayton, everybody. She's always out on tour with somebody. And so I thought, God, what if we could use flute for Darben? I mean, that would be really like crazy. Nobody does that for a villain. But it seemed right for her. So Elena did those initial demos and sang through the flute and did like all that crazy stuff. And then we also recorded 7 flutes at Abbey Road, including a contrabass flute, which literally you have to stand up to play, and people like held the flute. It's really heavy. So that's very much a part of the sound. But also, Zawe's performance is super breathy. Like, she takes a lot of gasping and breaths. And so the sense of breath and taking big breaths, we did it with choir, like they're that kind of 7-8 rhythm in breath. So we did that with the choir. We did that with the flutes. We did that with brass, breathing through their instruments. And we did it as a part of the rhythm behind the theme and as a part of playing of the theme. We didn't cut out the breaths. We didn't try to avoid them. So you have, you know, baruda da di, daruda bayo. So I instructed them all to breathe really rhythmically, so it felt like a part of the music. And of course, so they didn't die. It was also really good, you know, a kind act on my part. But no, I jest. So that was her thing. And then I thought, okay, let me see if I can get away with this, which I did. Over the theme suite for Darben, I had Elena improvise. So it goes da 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 ba 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 da, which is the, and then she goes da da ba da ba da da da, like Ornette Coleman, like wacky flute thing, and it's there in the end credits. So I just thought, oh God, I'll never get away with it. And then I remember when we were, I think they used it actually in the, it got used in the body of the film, also was kind of edited in there at one point. And then I just thought, oh my God, I've added jazz to the MCU. That now I've really accomplished something.
is there a kitchen sink in there? Because I feel like literally everything else is in the best possible way.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't a kitchen sink, but there is that space junk, which sounds kind of kitchen sinky at times. I got to admit, yes, we went and rented it from the thing, but probably the sink on the side of the house would have done the same thing sonically. But it's a good story to tell, at least, right? No, there were actually these titanium, really incredible things, these titanium domes that were very, very light, but made a very, very, like, low sound. And that was actually pretty extraordinary because the metal has to be so light to go out into space. And so that was unusual, I will say. I have, however, used kitchen sinks and other pieces of mine. I wrote a piece called All American where it literally has the kitchen sink in it, but not in the Marvels.
You can actually say you've used the kitchen sink. That's great. Yeah, it's I was interested because in my mind, when you look at musical storytelling in this particular field, where blockbuster cinema, comic book cinema in particular, you're looking at operatic symphonic scoring with experimentation, as we've discussed here. But I know, Laura, you were talking about there's always been a long-standing connection to the classical masters. And I wondered, like, for me, these superhero scores are kind of like modern day Wagner, like operas, like sort of symphonic operas. Would you say that's an accurate and a fair comparison to make?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I don't even know how much music there is, how much music. I wrote probably at least 2 hours of music. And it is symphonic. I mean, you know, there are movements. I mean, it is there. We talked about Aladdin, the singing part of Aladdin, but the whole second half of Aladdin is the longest battle in the movie, right? And I mean, that is very symphonic music with a lot of twists and turns in it, because of course it's got to fit action. But no, it's a big job and a glorious one.
I was thinking about Higher, Further, Faster, and to be honest with you, I think we've answered this question already, but I'll ask it nonetheless. Was that essentially coming into this, and it sounds very much like it was, but was that essentially your mantra for approaching this musically? Higher, Further, Faster.
Yeah, I think my mantra was, oh my God, you finally got the chance. Now do it. And I think for me, what was one of the really lovely things about it is that I'm so used to working in TV, and in TV, you know, the work is great, but it's fast. This wasn't. So there was a lot of time to consider stuff, to try stuff, to see if it worked. If it didn't work, it was okay, you know? And I had the trust, even though it was my first film, I'd already done Ms. Marvel and I had done What If. So I had the trust of the executives at Marvel. I had Nia's trust. And so that was also really beautiful. They believed in me, and they believed in what I could do, so I could try some of these things. If they didn't work, they didn't work. Tarnax, like the arrival at the Tarnax fight, that first terrible thing when everything's falling and Darben is taking out the air. That I had 7 tries on that one. You know, it was not easy. And I mean, I tried it many, many ways. And it was great to be able to do that and to keep the trust of the filmmakers while I said, let's try this. And I know I've read some articles about Ludvig Göransson, too, and I know that he does this, too. You know, that's the nice thing about Marvel is that you can try stuff a number of different ways, and people really entertain that and entertain the experimentation to see if something works, you know, and to try it out and to play scenes different ways.
Well, the MCU is at a junction now where in this film you do have the overlap between the world of Ms. Marvel from Disney Plus and then the world of this film. And I wondered, is there any musical crossover between the two properties, like for people who might be curious, are there musical overlaps?
A tiny little bit. Nia really wanted to have this be its own standalone thing. There's one time where Kamala puts on the bangle and she really references like her grandmother and her heritage. And so, yes, then I took music from Ms. Marvel, the first post-credit scene, you know, is a Ms. Marvel cue when she's walking into you see the skyline of New York and you feel that she's in New Jersey again. And so that I leaned into that. But other than that, really not. There was, I think, one other da-da-da-da-da-da when she's in 6 when she takes the scarf. In real 6, that's Aladdin, when she takes the scarf and starts to flip it around where I did it. But I really avoided that, mostly because Nia really wanted me to. She, you know, she didn't want references to the other properties, including the first Captain Marvel movie.
So it was quite a relatively streamlined musical approach to create that emotional directness, I imagine, with the audience.
I think so. I think it was. There frankly wasn't the musical real estate for it. You know what I mean? Like, I wrote a really extended family theme, which appears in kind of a smaller scale in a few places, but it didn't really wind up in the film, mostly because then we just started using, you know, the main theme in kind of that gesture. And it's funny because when you do a film, you know, you come up with these ideas. I mean, I wrote a Valkyrie theme, but it just didn't, there was no real estate. She just appears and then she goes away. So you're also dealing with how much time do you have to really have a theme, seed a theme, play with a theme, or a number of themes. And so there are kind of 4 themes in the movie. There's Darben, there's Higher, Further, Faster Together. There's a Requiem, which is da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and you hear it in Tarnax. You hear it when the water's being evacuated out of Aladdin, and that winds up being this kind of destruction theme, you know. And then there's this family theme, which winds up being really quite small and winds up just being the da-da-da-da-da-da. Ya, da, 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 da. You know, but it's just in little tiny pieces here and there. And then I was never able to do it in its full rendering.
I did want to ask about What If season two. Obviously, there is probably not a lot we can ask about it right now for obvious reasons, but I guess what can we expect from season two? I'm sure you're excited to be back, but what have you been preparing? What can you tell us about it?
Nothing. No, you can expect the unexpected, which is what If is about. You'll see a lot of people who are familiar to you in a lot of really wacky situations that are completely unfamiliar to you. Music is super fun. There are some new things that are pretty wacky. Brian Andrews, who's the director and, you know, essentially I think the showrunner of the show, he's a lover of movies. And, you know, so you'll see a lot of movies referenced, and it's a gas. And the way that they're airing it, I mean, it's really unusual, right? It's one episode a day. So it's you can't binge it, but you can kind of binge it. You can kind of be What If it's obsessed for, you know, for 10 days over Christmas or 9 days over Christmas. So that's such a fun show to work on. And it's a hard one, too, because, you know, frankly, every episode is like a its own movie.
One thing I do remember asking you about on our previous chat, Laura, we discussed at length the Alliance for Women Film Composers and the inroads that you'd made on that with the likes of Miriam Cutler, Lalita Ritmanis.
Thank you, Sean.
That was a really interesting discussion. I wondered, that with some 3 years on from when I last spoke to you about that, like about what developments that have been made, like progress that has been made relative to women composers in the industry.
Well, let's do a little experiment. Name me five women composers that you know.
Okay, me and John, we sharing this, or is it just on me?
Obviously, Laura Cartman, but that's obvious. Peanut O'Brack. Peanut O'Brack.
Let's make life easy for you.
Okay.
Start with the MCU. Yes.
Start with the MCU. Yourself, Pinar?
Pinar, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Loki. We have Rachel Portman.
Portman.
Who scored Loki? Yeah.
Natalie Holt.
Good. Who scored She-Hulk?
Oh.
Amy Dougherty.
Amy Dougherty, that was it. Thank you.
That's five right there.
There we go.
Yes.
How long did that take us?
A few seconds?
Yeah.
A few seconds. Now, Sean, if I'd asked you this 5 years ago, what would you have said?
I certainly wouldn't have been able to come up with as many answers as that.
Certainly not in five seconds.
No.
Yeah. So that shows you progress.
And, you know, now women are getting opportunities at a much higher level. And the thing is, what's been a privilege beyond a privilege, is when I started doing this work, I really, really didn't think that I would be the beneficiary of it. And I have been, you know, and I have another film out this year, American Fiction, which is really amazing.
Yes.
That's excellent. Yeah. So, I mean, I just having two really, you know, films that people are talking about is fantastic. But we have pushed forward. Now, you know, Germaine Franco got an Oscar nomination for Encanto, Michael Levy, Anna Meredith. I mean, Michael Levy did Zone of Interest. Hilda Gotten-Dottir, nobody mentioned her. She won an Oscar for Joker. So right now we've got, you're seeing women in the conversations really annually, which is big. Now we just have to look for more gender parity. And so we have to push a little bit harder. I think we've made great inroads in television. We need to make a little bit more progress in terms of the top projects. But I think more than anything, you know, we want to get to the point, and I think we are getting there, where we're being considered for what we can do musically and for a unique perspective. And I think that's why, listen, you go to every single person. You know, you like, we can sit here and talk about, let's talk about Ludwig. You go to Ludwig because Ludwig has the sort of the mind of a song producer and chops of an orchestral composer. So he's got that vibe, which is really cool. And he does that so very well. You know, you go to Michael for what Michael does. You go to different people for what they do. And I think of your identity, you know, whether it's coming from Sweden and growing up with popper Michael Giacchino, growing up on soundtracks, being a director, or me growing up with classical music, or Anna Meredith having this like cool like band where she creates these like amazing sounds. Every single person has their identity. And that identity can be reflected in their gender, in their sort of the way that they live, their queerness, their color, their, you know, hundreds of different ways. And so what we want is we want to continue to widen the field. You know, we watched this movie last night, Past Lives, beautiful film. And there was this moment where it, I can't believe I'm saying this in public, but I will say it in public. There's this moment where he comes to New York and there are these love shots of New York City, the kind of shots that Woody Allen used to do, you know, those kind of like, and I just thought, oh my God, how wonderful that we get to see this through these eyes. It made it so much more wonderful. And like American Fiction too is like the kind of witty, urbane movie that you would wait in line to see that Woody Allen would do. But now we're seeing it through the eyes of Court Jefferson, and we're seeing it through the eyes of a Black perspective, a Black American perspective. And it's like, I appreciate those perspectives, even if they're not my own. You know, I don't know what it's like to be a Korean immigrant, but I did a little bit for 2 hours last night when I was watching this movie. And I love that. That's the whole point of this. That's the whole point. And it's about like celebrating the fact that different perspectives bring cultural richness to all of these projects. And that doesn't knock anybody out. It just, it makes the hug a little wider. That's all.
It's movie making is an empathy machine, as Roger Ebert once said.
That's right. And so, film scoring is an exercise in deep empathy. That's what we do, right? We have to empathize with everybody, including the villains. And so that's the gig.
Laura, it's wonderful to talk to you today. I just reflecting on, obviously, we've mentioned some of your upcoming projects, What If, and so on and so forth. But if you can tell us anything about what you're excited about for the upcoming year, and obviously we're now almost, can you believe it? We're almost at the end of 2023 already. But what have you got coming up that you can share with us or tell us about that that you're very excited about?
Well, What If season three. Two other things that I can't talk to you about, but one is a large scale video game, which everybody's going to love. Another one is Cuckoo Crazy, and it'll be out. I don't know when it's coming out, but I can't tell you anything about that. But the other thing that we're doing is really cool. I've actually optioned the rights to a movie called Dance Girl Dance. And it was directed by Dorothy Arzner, who was the only woman directing in the golden age of Hollywood. And it's a genre film with a feminist perspective, and I'm going to make a movie out of it. A musicalized movie with my wife, Nora. We're going to do it together. And we're going to write songs and so the whole world will know who Dorothy Arzner was when we're done.
Oh, please come back and tell us all about it and share your process with us.
I will. Thank you guys so much for having me on.
Thank you for coming back. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Laura.
Take care. Bye-bye.
The Marvelous, see what I did there, Laura Cartman speaking to Sean and I at the end of last year about her work on The Marvels and so much more. Thank you, Laura. What a great chat. Really enjoyed that. Thank you. To get more details on Laura, check out her website, lauracartman.com, and she's all across social media too. All of the music of Laura's that we discussed is available now. Our thanks again to Marvel Music, Hollywood Records and Disney Music, as well as our friends at Sony Soundtracks for their support. What If Seasons 1 and 2 are now streaming on Disney Plus. The Marvels makes its Disney Plus debut in February, as does the 4K Blu-ray and DVD editions. They're due also at the end of Feb, with the Disney Plus version due on the 7th. And the film for which she received her first Oscar nomination, American Fiction, drops into UK cinemas on the 2nd of February too. You can, of course, see that at Vue. Thank you again to our friends at Vue Cinemas for all of their support. And check out your nearest Vue at myvue.com. Thank you again to Laura for her time. Thank you to Sean Wilson for being the best co-pilot, as always. And to all our friends at Express FM Studios, where these episodes are made. And of course, thank you too for listening. To get more updates, then by all means follow at Need a Bigger Pod on socials. I'm also at John Brown TV. That's at J-O-N Brown TV on all platforms. Or you can follow Sean on X at Seano22. That's S-E-A-N at Seano22. Or on Instagram at Sean Filmwriter. Until next time, thank you. And as always, friends, keep that soundtrack collection stacked very, very high.